That was supposed to be the anniversary of everything she had built. 21 years, 21 years she had given to that house, to that name, to that man. Every ledger balanced in secret, every speech written in her own hand and spoken as his. She wore the emerald brooch that night. She believed for one foolish moment that he might finally say the words she had waited 2 decades to hear. Instead, before the whole of London, he called her service, not love, service. And then he took another woman's hand in the very gesture he once used only for her. She did not cry. She did not beg. She unpinned the brooch, placed it in his palm, and walked out of that ballroom in a silence no one dared to break. But the fog outside did not lead her to ruin. It led her to a locked door, a door her own father had sealed for 35 years, and behind it, a truth that would make the man who humiliated her wish more than anything that he had never let her go. Because London was about to learn something no ballroom announcement could undo. Some women are not discarded. They are simply not yet recognized. Rain fell over Thornwick Hall, the way it always did in the deep of winter, thin and steady, tapping against tall windows like fingers asking to be let in. Inside the library, a single candle burned low on the mahogany desk, and Clara Sterling, Duchess of Thornwick Hall, sat surrounded by ledgers that told the true story of the estate her husband ruled in name only. It was past midnight. The fire had settled into embers. Clara did not notice the cold anymore. 21 years of these nights had taught her how to work through it, how to keep her hand steady on the pen, even when her fingers ached, how to read columns of numbers until the debts and the harvests and the wages made sense again. Gideon was in London. He had been there 3 days, receiving praise at dinners for stabilizing a dukedom that would have collapsed twice over without the woman he left behind. Clara did not resent this the way she once feared she might. She had simply accepted it, the way she accepted rain in winter, as a fact of the life she had chosen. She looked down at the ledger in front of her. Tenant debts on the Ashworth farms. Repairs needed on 6 cottages before spring flooding came again. A letter from a minister in Parliament requesting figures on grain output that Gideon would read aloud in 3 days as though he had calculated them himself. Clara had calculated them. She always did. Her eyes drifted, unbidden, to a small oval portrait resting on the corner of the desk. It showed a much younger Gideon and a much younger Clara, taken the year they married. In the painting, Gideon looked at her the way men look at something they cannot quite believe belongs to them. Clara remembered that look. She remembered how it had felt to be the center of a man's whole attention, how his hand used to find hers under the dinner table without either of them planning it. She set the portrait face down, gently, the way one puts an old friend to rest. 21 years ago, she had come to this marriage as a girl with a modest inheritance and a father everyone believed was nothing more than a quiet, bookish gentleman living out his days in the countryside. Gideon had come to it as a young man who had just inherited a title, and, though few outside the family knew it, an estate already bleeding money from bad investments made by his own father. She remembered the first winter of their marriage clearly, the way Gideon had paced the study at Thornwick Hall, his voice cracking as he confessed that he did not know how to save the house that bore his name. Clara had not laughed at him, had not pitied him. She had simply rolled up her sleeves, sat beside him at that same desk, and begun to work. She negotiated with tenants who had every right to be furious over unpaid repairs. She sold 2 strands of her mother's pearls, quietly without telling a soul, so that 3 farming families would not lose their homes during a failed harvest. She wrote letters to widows of servants who had died in service to the estate, letters so warm and so careful that more than one widow had kept them pressed inside a Bible for years afterward. She learned the names of every servant's child, remembered their birthdays, brought them small gifts at Christmas before she ever thought of buying anything for herself. And she wrote speeches, dozens of them over the years, tucked inside Gideon's coat pocket before he left for London, words she had shaped late at night after the household had gone to sleep. She listened, afterward, as London praised the Duke of Thornwick for his eloquence, his clarity, his understanding of the common man's troubles. She never once asked for her name to be spoken alongside his. She had believed for a very long time that this was simply what a good wife did, what a good duchess did. Love to Clara had always meant standing quietly behind a man and holding up the parts of him the world was not meant to see. There had been tenderness once, real and unhurried. She remembered a night in this very library, years ago, when Gideon had taken her cold hands between his own and warmed them with his breath before either of them said a word. She remembered him reading poetry to her while snow gathered on the windowsill, his voice low, his shoulder pressed against hers. She remembered dancing with him after the last guest had gone home, no music but the sound of their own soft laughter, his hand at the small of her back as though she were the only woman in the world worth holding. He had once told her, in this room, that he would be lost without her. She had believed him completely. That man felt like a stranger to her now. Something had shifted these past months, slowly enough that Clara had told herself she was imagining it. Gideon no longer asked what she thought before making decisions. He no longer sat beside her at breakfast, choosing instead the far end of the table, his eyes on his correspondence rather than on her. He no longer touched her shoulder in passing, the way he used to, a habit so old and so constant, she had stopped noticing it until it disappeared. And there were the letters, pink wax seals, arriving with unusual frequency, disappearing into his coat before she could see the hand that had written them. She told herself it was nothing. A distant cousin, a political matter. She told herself this the way a woman tells herself many things she is not yet ready to face. Gideon's letters from London that week had spoken of a name she was hearing more and more often. Lady Vivian Kensington. Fresh, he called her. Clever. A welcome brightness at gatherings that had grown tiresome. Clara read these lines without comment and folded the letter back into its envelope, her hands perfectly steady, though something cold had begun to settle beneath her ribs. She told herself again that it was nothing. 3 days later, Gideon returned to Thornwick Hall to prepare for the Royal Spring Ball, an event that had, for 21 years, marked the beginning of the London season and, more privately, the anniversary of their marriage. Clara had always treasured it. This year, she found herself watching her husband with a wariness she did not want to name. He was distracted at dinner, his replies short, his gaze fixed somewhere past her shoulder. When she asked, gently, whether something troubled him, he said only that he had a great deal on his mind, and that she should not worry herself over matters of politics. She had heard that phrase before, in various forms, over the years. She had always accepted it. That night, for the first time, it did not sit easily in her chest. The night of the ball arrived wrapped in a beauty Clara would remember for the rest of her life, though not for the reasons she expected. Thornwick House in London blazed with candlelight. Crystal chandeliers scattered gold across the ceiling. Champagne moved through the crowd in a river of quiet, clinking glass. Silk gowns swept across polished floors, and the uniforms of visiting officers gleamed under the light. Representatives of the crown stood near the dais, their presence a mark of how significant the evening was meant to be. Clara wore deep green silk, and at her collar sat the emerald ducal brooch, the same brooch every Duchess of Thornwick had worn since the title was first granted. She had polished it herself that afternoon, her fingers lingering on the stone the way they always did on nights that mattered. She believed, walking into that ballroom on Gideon's arm, that tonight he might finally speak of the 21 years behind them. She allowed herself, just once, the small and foolish hope that he would take her hand before all of London and thank her, truly thank her, for everything she had carried in silence. The music slowed. The crowd gathered near. The dais. Gideon stepped forward, and for one breath, Clara's heart lifted. He thanked her. He said the words in a voice pitched for the whole room to hear, warm enough to sound like affection to anyone who did not know him as she did. He thanked Clara for her years of loyal service to Thornwick Hall. Service. Not love, not partnership, not devotion. Service as though she were a steward who had finally completed a long contract. Clara stood very still, her gloved hands folded in front of her, and told herself she had misheard the weight of it. She had no time to recover before Gideon turned toward the edge of the dais and extended his hand to a young woman in pale rose silk. Lady Vivian Kensington was 23, radiant in the particular way of a woman who has never once doubted that a room would rearrange itself around her. Gideon announced, his voice steady and pleased, that Lady Vivian would accompany him through the coming seasons, and that once the necessary legal divorce arrangements were completed, she would become the new Duchess of Thornwick Hall. The ballroom went utterly silent. Clara felt the silence more than she heard it, a stillness that pressed against her skin like cold water. She looked at the faces around her, faces she had known for years, dined with, comforted, helped in ways they would never learn. Not one of them met her eyes. Not one of them spoke a word in her defense. Somewhere near the dais, a woman looked down into her champagne glass rather than look at Clara at all. A gentleman near the doors studied the toe of his own boot with sudden, desperate interest. The silence of a crowded room, Clara learned in that moment, can be louder than any accusation. Vivian smiled the smile of a woman who already believed she had won something. Gideon placed his hand at her waist, the same gesture. The exact same gesture he had once used to guide Clara onto a dance floor after their own wedding. He led Vivian into the first steps of a dance while the orchestra, uncertain what else to do, continued to play. That gesture wounded Clara more deeply than the announcement itself. An announcement was politics. A hand at a waist, warm and familiar, was proof that whatever tenderness Gideon had once given her, he was now giving to someone else, freely, without apology, in front of everyone who had ever admired their marriage. Clara did not weep. She did not raise her voice. Something in her, some old and steady part, built over 21 years of quiet strength, rose up and carried her through what might otherwise have broken her completely. She reached up, slowly, and unfastened the emerald ducal brooch from her collar. She crossed the small distance to where Gideon stood, and she placed it in his open palm without a single word. Then she turned to the royal representatives near the dais and lowered herself into a curtsy so correct, so composed, that even the coldest observer in that room would later admit They had never seen dignity worn so completely as armor. Then she walked out. The silence followed her the length of the ballroom, out through the great doors, down the marble steps, and into the London fog that swallowed her carriage whole. She did not look back. She did not need to. She had already seen everything that mattered. Inside the carriage, alone at last, Clara allowed herself one long, shuddering breath. She pressed her gloved hand against the cold window glass and watched London blur past in streaks of lamplight and rain. She believed, in that moment, that her life had ended. 21 years, dissolved in the space of a single sentence and a stranger's hand at a young woman's waist. She did not yet know that her father, dead nearly a decade, had spent 35 years quietly preparing an entirely different future for her, one that had nothing to do with Gideon Stirling at all. As the carriage rolled deeper into the fog, a memory rose in Clara's mind, unbidden and strangely comforting. Her father, near the end of his life, sitting in his favorite chair by the fire, his hand closing gently over hers. "If the world ever takes your name from you, Clara," he had told her, "return to Eldermore. I left you the truth." She had not understood the words then. She had assumed them the soft wandering of a dying man's affection. She understood now that she had nowhere else left to go. She gave the driver new instructions before the fog had fully cleared from the London streets, not back to Thornwick Hall, not to any house that carried Gideon's name, to Eldermore Manor, to the truth her father had promised her. The journey took the better part of 2 days, and Clara spent much of it in the strange, suspended calm that follows a great shock, the kind of stillness the body offers before grief is finally permitted to arrive in full. She watched the countryside change outside the carriage window, watched London smoke and stone give way to open fields, hedgerows, and the long grey ribbons of rivers she remembered from childhood visits to her father's house, visits that had grown rarer once her own household duties swallowed nearly every hour of her days. She thought somewhere along that road of the girl she had been at 19, standing beside Gideon at their own wedding, believing with her whole young heart that devotion given freely would always, eventually, be returned in kind. She did not regret that girl's hope. She simply understood now that hope alone had never once been enough to keep a marriage honest. She thought of Vivian, too, though she tried not to dwell there long. Not with hatred, though she searched herself honestly for it, and found only a hollow kind of pity. Vivian was young enough to still believe that being chosen by a powerful man meant something lasting. Clara had believed that once as well. She wondered, briefly and without malice, how many years it would take before Vivian learned what Clara herself had spent 2 decades learning the hard way. By the time the carriage finally turned onto the overgrown drive leading to Eldermore, rain had begun to fall again, soft and grey, and Clara felt something in her chest loosen slightly at the sight of the old stone house rising out of the mist. Whatever waited for her inside those walls, it belonged to her alone. No one would stand before a crowded room and take it from her with a single, careless sentence. That, she told herself, would have to be enough for now. Eldermore Manor had been sleeping for nearly 10 years, and it looked, as Clara's carriage rolled up the overgrown drive at dawn, like a house that had given up waiting to be woken. Ivy had crept across the stone walls. The gardens her father once tended with such quiet devotion had grown warped and tangled. Shutters hung closed over every window, and the whole estate wore the stillness of a place built to hold memory other than life. Clara stood before the great oak door, for a long moment before she found the strength to lift the old iron knocker. She was not arriving as a duchess today. She was arriving as a woman with no husband, no home, and no name that still meant anything in London. The housekeeper who answered, an elderly woman named Mrs. Prewitt, who had served Lord Edmund Robinson for 30 years, did not ask questions. She simply looked at Clara's face, at the exhaustion carved into it, and opened the door wider. Your father always said you would come back when you needed the truth more than you needed comfort, Mrs. Prewitt said quietly. I did not think it would be so soon. Clara walked through rooms that still smelled faintly of her father's pipe tobacco and old paper. His study remained untouched, exactly as he had left it. His chair sat angled toward the fireplace. His walking cane leaned against the desk. Rows of books climbed the walls in careful order, the way he had always kept them. She stood in the doorway of that study and felt the full weight of the last day finally catch up to her. Not the loud grief of tears and sobbing, but a smaller, quieter collapse. One hand pressed flat against the cold surface of his desk, her breath shaking, the realization settling into her bones that she had no husband waiting for her anywhere, no home she could claim as her own, no place left in the society that had watched her walk out of that ballroom without a single voice raised in her defense. She allowed herself perhaps 10 minutes of that grief before she straightened her spine, the way she always did, and reminded herself that grief had never once solved a ledger or saved a tenant family, and it would not save her now either. It was on the third day, while helping Mrs. Prewitt clean years of dust from the study, that Clara noticed something strange about the floor beneath the tallest bookcase. Faint scratches, curved and repeated, as though something heavy had been moved across that spot again and again over many years. She knelt and studied the bookcase itself. Rows of Roman histories filled the lowest shelf, their spines worn from handling far more frequent than a retired scholar's quiet reading habits would explain. She pulled one volume free, then another. And, behind the third, her fingers found a small brass lever set into the wood, hidden so carefully that 100 ordinary visitors might have missed it entirely. She pressed it. The bookcase groaned, shifted, and swung inward on a hinge built into the stone wall behind it. Clara stood in the opening for a long moment, her candle trembling slightly in her hand, and stared into a room she had never known existed inside her father's quiet country house. The hidden library was smaller than the study, but every inch of it spoke of something far larger than the modest scholar her father had always claimed to be. Shelves lined with sealed letters, wax stamped with crests she recognized from the greatest noble houses in England, coded journals bound in leather, their pages filled with symbols and abbreviations she did not yet understand. Maps of Europe marked with small annotations in her father's careful hand. Lists, long lists, of noble families with notes beside each name that read like the private history of a nation. On the far wall hung a portrait of her father she had never seen before. In it, he did not wear the gentle, distracted expression she remembered from childhood. He wore an expression of quiet command, the look of a man who had spent decades holding secrets that could topple houses, and who had carried that weight without ever once letting it show at the dinner table. Clara found the letter addressed to her on the desk at the center of the room, sealed with the same wax crest she had seen on 100 other envelopes throughout her life without ever questioning it. Her hands shook slightly as she broke the seal. My dearest Clara, the letter began, if you are reading this, then the world has finally asked more of you than it asked of your husband, and you have come looking for the truth I could never give you while I lived. I was never merely a retired scholar living quietly in the countryside. For 35 years, I served the crown in a manner no history book will ever record. I settled disputes between noble houses before they became scandals that could shake the nation. I prevented feuds that would have spilled blood across 3 counties. I protected treaties that kept peace between families who despised one another. I preserved the stability of England from behind a curtain no one but a handful of trusted men ever saw drawn back. I never accepted a title for this work. I never sought recognition. And I never told you, because I wanted you to grow up as a girl who believed in kindness for its own sake, not as a woman burdened too soon with the weight of secrets. But my life's work was never meant to end with me, Clara. It was always meant to belong to you. Clara set the letter down and pressed both hands against her mouth. Her whole understanding of her quiet, gentle father dissolving and reforming into something she had never imagined. The man who had taught her to read by candlelight, who had walked her through these very gardens, naming every flower, had also been quietly holding the peace of an entire nation together with nothing but careful words and patient diplomacy. She was still standing there, letter in hand, when the sound of carriage wheels reached her through the open window. A tall figure stepped down into the misty morning light, dressed in dark, well-tailored mourning grey, despite the years that had passed since his own wife's death. He moved with the quiet authority of a man used to command, without ever needing to raise his voice. Mrs. Pruitt led him into the study, and Clara turned to face him, still holding her father's letter as though it might vanish if she let it go. "Lady Clara," the man said, and bowed with a gravity that felt entirely unlike the pity she had grown used to receiving these past days. "Forgive the early hour. I am Alexander Faulkner, Marquess of Ashbourne. Your father was my closest friend for the better part of 20 years. Clara studied him, dignified, restrained. A widower, she recalled hearing once, though she could not place where. There was something steady in his eyes that made her feel, for the first time since the ballroom, that the ground beneath her had stopped shaking. "He told me once that England would not need him forever," Alexander said, quietly. "I did not understand him then. I understand him quite well now, looking at this room, and at you." "You knew about all of this," Clara said. It was not quite a question. "I knew a great deal of it. Not all. Your father kept even his closest friends at a careful distance from the fullest truth." Alexander's gaze moved briefly to the shelves, then returned to her face, and something in his expression softened. "He spoke of you often, Lady Clara. More often, I think, than you might have guessed." Clara felt a strange warmth rise in her chest at those words, unexpected and unfamiliar after so many months of feeling unseen. She set the letter aside and gestured toward the desk, where a heavy ledger lay closed beneath a layer of dust. Alexander stepped closer and opened it without asking permission, the ease of long familiarity with her father's papers evident in his hands. He turned pages slowly until he found what he seemed to already know was there, and angled the book so she could read it herself. Beside her own name, written in her father's careful hand, were the words, "My successor, if courage has survived grief." Clara could not speak. Her throat had closed around something too large for words. "Your father did not leave you a refuge, Lady Clara," Alexander said softly, and there was something in his voice, some careful warmth held deliberately in check, that made the words land closer to her heart than she expected. He left you a kingdom of unfinished promises. She looked up at him, and for a moment neither of them spoke. He did not touch her, though he stood close enough that she could feel the quiet warmth of him, close enough to notice the careful way he held himself back, as though afraid that anything more might frighten the woman who had just watched her whole life dissolve in a ballroom 3 days before. When he finally took her gloved hand to bow over it in farewell, his lips did not quite touch the fabric, but she felt the warmth of his breath against her knuckles, and something in her chest, something she had thought Gideon had permanently silenced, stirred quietly awake. "There is little time to grieve what was taken from you, Lady Clara," Alexander said, straightening, his voice returning to its steady, careful register. "One of your father's oldest alliances is close to collapse. Two of England's most powerful houses stand on the edge of a feud that could ruin them both in Parliament and in society alike, and your father is no longer here to prevent it." Clara looked down at the ledger, at her own name written in her father's hand, at the quiet certainty of a man who had trusted her with more than she had ever trusted herself. Before they departed, Clara lingered a moment longer in the hidden library, running her fingers along the spines of journals that held 35 years of quiet sacrifice she had never once suspected. She thought of all the evenings her father had sat by the fire at Eldermore, apparently doing nothing more than reading, while in truth his mind had likely been turning over the fate of families whose names she was only now beginning to learn. "Did he ever seem burdened to you?" she asked Alexander quietly. "In all the years you knew him, did the weight of it ever show?" Alexander considered the question with the same careful thoughtfulness he brought to everything. "Only once that I ever witnessed. The night before he signed the treaty that ended the Ashford feud, he sat with me by this very fire and said that the hardest part of his work was never the danger of it, nor the secrecy. It was watching people he cared for suffer, while he alone possessed the means to ease that suffering, and having to wait, sometimes for years, until the moment was right to act." "That sounds like a lonely way to live," Clara said softly. "I believe it was," Alexander said. "I think that is precisely why he wanted this life to belong to you, and not to a stranger appointed by the crown. He did not want you to carry it alone the way he so often did." Clara looked at him then, standing steady and patient in the candlelight of her father's hidden library, and felt for the first time since the ballroom something that was not quite hope, but stood very near to it. "Then I suppose," she said, and her voice, to her own surprise, came out steady, "we had better not let it collapse." That night, alone in the small bedroom she had chosen at Eldermore, the same room she had slept in as a girl during Fimbarntuyat, Umshasamatotur, summer visits, Clara sat by the window and watched moonlight settle over the wild, overgrown gardens below. She thought of her father walking those same paths decades ago, carrying secrets heavy enough to shape the fate of nations, and never once letting the weight of them touch the gentle, patient man she remembered from her childhood. She wondered how he had managed it, how a man could hold that much power quietly, without ever once needing the world to see it. She thought of Gideon, who had needed London's admiration the way other men needed food or air, and she understood with a clarity that surprised her why her father had never told her the truth while he lived. He had wanted her to know kindness first, before she ever learned what it cost to hold real influence in careful, invisible hands. She thought too of Alexander's voice in the study, low and steady, telling her that her father had left her a kingdom of unfinished promises rather than a mere refuge. She did not yet understand the full shape of what that meant. But she understood, lying awake long after the candle burned down to nothing, that she was no longer simply a woman running from a ballroom full of silence. She was becoming something else entirely, something she had not yet found the words for, and for the first time since that terrible night, the thought did not frighten her. It steadied her. The carriage rolled through mist-covered countryside, past wet hedgerows and church towers dark against a pale morning sky, and Clara watched the fields slide by, silvered with frost, and tried to steady the nervous flutter that had not left her chest since Eldermore. "I do not know what I am meant to say to these men," she admitted, breaking the silence that had settled between them since they left the manor. "I am only a rejected wife with my father's ledger, and no idea what any of it truly means." Alexander turned from the window to look at her, and there was nothing pitying in his expression, only a kind of quiet certainty that made her want to believe him. "You are not here because a duke discarded you," he said. "You are here because your father trusted you. Those are not the same woman, Lady Clara, and I think you already know it." She held on to those words for the rest of the journey, turning them over the way she once turned over ledger figures, searching for the truth hidden inside them. Kingsmere Hall rose out of the mist an hour later, grand and grey, and Lord Charles Holloway, an elderly peer with silver hair and a voice that had clearly commanded rooms for 50 years, rose from his chair the moment Clara entered his study. He did not wait for introductions. His eyes found the seal on the letter she carried, her father's seal, and something in his composed face broke open. "Your father saved my sons from killing each other, over an inheritance neither of them deserved," he said, his voice rough. "I never thanked him properly. I did not think I would have the chance." Clara listened as he told the story of two brothers who had nearly drawn swords over a disputed estate, of the quiet letters her father had exchanged with each of them separately, patient and careful, until the fury had drained out of both young men, and something like brotherhood had grown back in its place. "The newspapers never wrote a word of it," Lord Holloway said. "Your father preferred it that way. He always said credit was heavier to carry than most men understood." At Silver Oak Hall the following day, General Arthur Wallace, broad-shouldered and blunt in his speech, told Clara how her father had secretly redirected military supplies during a crisis that could have left British troops stranded and starving abroad. "The papers praised the generals who received those supplies," he said, pouring her tea with hands still steady despite his years. "The generals knew better than to correct them. Your father asked for nothing but silence in return, and we gave it gladly, because silence was the only currency he ever wanted." Clara began to understand, standing in that drawing room, the true scale of the life her father had lived without her ever suspecting it. Every kindness he had shown her as a child, every patient lesson in the garden, had existed alongside decisions that shaped the fate of entire counties. The real test came at Winthorpe Abbey, where two families had gathered to argue over land rights, tenant access, and a debt neither side would admit to owing. The room had grown loud, voices overlapping, old grievances dragged back into the light with fresh venom. Clara did not raise her voice to match theirs. She waited until a natural pause opened in the shouting, and then she asked a single precise question about why the debt in question had never been formally recorded in either family's accounts. The room went quiet. It became clear within moments that the true dispute had nothing to do with land or money at all. It was pride, old and stubborn, dressed up in the language of ownership. Clara offered a compromise that protected the tenants caught in the middle and allowed both families to walk away with their dignity intact. And by the time she finished speaking, the anger in the room had drained away like water through cupped hands. One of the elder gentlemen, still flushed from his own shouting, turned to Alexander afterward with open bewilderment. "How did she see it so plainly, when neither of our families could see it in 10 years of quarreling?" "Because she was not listening for who was right," Alexander answered quietly. "She was listening for what everyone was actually afraid of losing." Alexander watched her from across the room, and something in his expression had shifted since the morning they left Eldermore. He was no longer simply observing the daughter of a man he had admired. He was watching a woman solve, with nothing but patience and precision, a problem that two noble families, with all their wealth and status, had failed to solve on their own. That evening, in the courtyard outside Winthorpe Abbey, Clara knelt without hesitation to comfort a tenant child who had grown frightened by the raised voices inside. She removed her gloves, wiped a smear of mud from the boy's cheek with her bare thumb, and asked his name as gently as if he were the only person in the world who mattered in that moment. Alexander stood in the doorway and watched. And it was here, in this small, unremarkable moment that no history book would ever record, that something in his chest quietly and irreversibly gave way. He had admired her already for her father's sake, for the sharpness of her mind, for the calm way she carried herself through rooms that would have broken lesser women. But it was her hands on a frightened child's face, her voice soft enough that only the boy could hear it, that made him understand he was no longer simply admiring her. He was falling in love with her, slowly, the way a man falls in love with something he recognizes as rare rather than something he merely desires. Far away, at Thornwick Hall, a different kind of unraveling had begun. Vivian stood in the middle of the drawing room, arms crossed, complaining that the cook required decisions she did not know how to make, that tenants kept arriving at the door with grievances she found tiresome, that the steward would not stop asking for signatures on documents she did not understand. "Surely servants handle such things," she said, waving a dismissive hand. Mr. Harlan Goodwin, the steward, stood near the door with the particular patience of a man who had served this house for 20 years and had never once needed to explain such matters to its Duchess. "Her Grace handled them before they became such things," he replied quietly. Gideon, seated near the fire with a letter he was not truly reading, felt the words land somewhere he did not want them to. He said nothing. He simply stared at the flames a moment longer than necessary, and something cold settled where certainty used to sit. At his club that same week, over cards and cigar smoke, Gideon heard a name that stopped his hand mid-motion. "Robinson's daughter has begun answering letters," one gentleman said to another, low enough that he clearly did not intend Gideon to hear, though the room's sudden quiet suggested otherwise. "Word is, she settled the Holloway inheritance dispute herself, quite decisively, from what I understand." The room went still in a way Gideon did not fully understand, though he sensed with an unease he could not name that it mattered a great deal more than he wanted it to. Back on the road toward the next estate on her father's list, Clara's exhaustion finally caught up with her during a long, rain-soaked stretch of the journey. She fell asleep against the carriage window without meaning to, her head tipping gently as the wheels rocked over uneven ground. Alexander watched her for a long moment, the candle inside the carriage lamp, throwing soft gold light across her tired face, and then, without waking her, he removed his own coat and laid it gently across her lap for warmth. When she woke an hour later, disoriented and faintly embarrassed, their eyes met in the dim carriage light, and neither of them looked away as quickly as propriety demanded. The silence stretched longer than it should have. Clara felt warmth rise in her cheeks, unfamiliar and startling, after so many months of feeling nothing at all where warmth used to live. And she looked down at his coat, still resting across her knees, rather than continue meeting his gaze. "Forgive me," she murmured. "I did not mean to fall asleep." "There is nothing to forgive," Alexander said, his voice quieter than usual. "I would rather you slept than exhausted yourself further on my account." Neither of them spoke again for the rest of the journey, but the silence between them had changed shape, and Clara found herself unwilling to examine too closely what that change might mean. They arrived back at Eldermore to find a sealed letter waiting, carrying the mark of the Lord Chancellor's own office. Clara broke the seal with fingers that had grown steadier over these past weeks, and read the words that would carry her, at last, into the very heart of London's power. "Lady Clara Stirling is requested in London regarding matters of national confidence left by Lord Edmund Robinson." She looked up at Alexander, and for the first time since the ballroom, she did not feel like a woman who had lost everything. She felt like a woman about to discover exactly what she still had. London in early summer smelled of rain-washed stone and coal smoke, and Clara walked through it now with a steadiness she had not possessed 3 weeks earlier. She entered a private chamber near Westminster with her father's ledger tucked beneath her arm, and found Lord Benedict Randolph, the Lord Chancellor, waiting behind a wide desk stacked with papers that bore seals from half the noble houses in England. He did not look at her the way London had looked at her the night of the ball. He looked at her the way a man looks at someone he has been waiting a long time to finally meet. "Lady Clara," he said, rising, "your father mediated a number of confidential agreements between our great houses over the years, arrangements that kept peace where pride alone would have caused war. Several of those agreements now require renewal, and there is no one left alive who understands their terms as you might, given what he left you." Clara felt the weight of the room settle onto her shoulders, heavier than any ledger she had ever balanced. Alexander stood near the window, silent, steady, close enough that she could feel his quiet presence anchoring her, even though he said nothing at all. Her first true test came within days. Two noble families, their names carrying more history than either seemed willing to respect, threatened to expose damaging secrets about one another unless the Crown favored their particular interests in an upcoming matter of inheritance. The dispute had the shape of every feud her father had spent decades preventing, and Clara understood, reading through his old journals late into the night, exactly what kind of solution he would have proposed. By morning, she presented it herself. A marriage settlement between two younger children of the feuding families, a restructuring of old debts that had quietly poisoned both houses for a generation, and a public charitable alliance that would let both families claim credit for something admirable rather than continue clawing at each other's reputations. The Lord Chancellor studied her proposal for a long moment before looking up with something close to astonishment. "Your father would be proud," he said simply. Later that evening, walking beside her through a quiet corridor after the meeting, Alexander spoke words that settled into Clara's chest and stayed there. "You do not enter a room demanding obedience," he said. "You enter it carrying clarity. That is far rarer than people realize, and far more valuable." Clara glanced at him, unused to praise that expected nothing from her in return, no service rendered afterward, no quiet debt she would spend years repaying. "You say that as though it costs you nothing to notice such things." "It costs me nothing at all," Alexander said, and something in his voice, careful and low, made her breath catch. "It has simply taken me longer than I would like to admit to find the words for what I see when I look at you." She did not know how to answer that, and so she said nothing, though the warmth of it followed her long after they parted for the evening. At Thornwick Hall, the collapse Clara had once quietly prevented for 21 years had finally arrived in full. Gideon sat across from his steward, staring at figures that made no sense to him. Unpaid wages, inaccurate ledgers, a failed investment that should have been caught and corrected months ago. "How long has this been happening?" Gideon demanded. "Her Grace managed the estate's investments personally, Your Grace," Harlan Goodwin said, his voice carefully neutral. "She caught errors like this one before they became losses. I assumed you were aware." "Why was I never told?" Gideon's voice cracked with something between anger and disbelief. Harlan met his eyes without flinching. "You never asked, Your Grace." The words landed like a physical blow. Gideon sat in silence long after the steward left the room, staring at ledgers filled with a decade of quiet competence he had never once thought to question, and understanding for the first time how much of his own reputation had been built on hands he had barely noticed. Vivian's patience, meanwhile, had begun to fray in ways that revealed more of her character than she likely intended. She wanted invitations, jewels, admiration. She did not want tenant complaints, ill servants, or the endless quiet labor that had kept this house standing. When an elderly housekeeper brought her a minor household matter requiring a decision, Vivian dismissed her with a sharpness that left the older woman near tears, and within days the servants of Thornwick Hall had begun withdrawing whatever loyalty they had cautiously extended to their new mistress. Back at Eldermore, after a rare afternoon of summer rain finally gave way to soft golden light, Clara walked with Alexander through the rose garden her father had once tended with such care. The stones beneath their feet were still slick from the storm, and the air carried the heavy, sweet scent of wet roses mixed with the clean smell of rain-soaked earth. Clara's foot slipped on a smooth stone before she even registered the danger, and Alexander caught her by the waist before she could fall, pulling her against him in one swift, instinctive motion. For a long moment, neither of them moved. Her hands had come to rest against his chest, and she could feel beneath the fabric of his coat the quick, unsteady rhythm of his heartbeat, a rhythm that matched her own far too closely for either of them to pretend otherwise. His face was close enough that she could see the fine details of his eyes, the careful restraint in them warring visibly with something far less careful. "Forgive me," Alexander said, his voice low and rough at the edges. "I should let you go."
"Yes,"
Clara whispered, and did not move. "You should." Neither of them did. The scent of rain and roses and warm leather filled the small space between them, and Clara felt something she had believed long dead stir awake in her chest, a hunger she had no name for and no defense against, built slowly over weeks of careful glances and quiet kindnesses rather than a single reckless moment. She was aware of every place his hands touched her, aware of the restraint costing him visibly, aware that if either of them leaned forward even slightly, something between them would change forever. A servant's voice called from the house, breaking the moment before it could become anything more. They separated slowly, reluctantly, and neither spoke of it as they walked back toward the manor, though Clara could feel the longing settle into her bones and refuse to leave. Back at Thornwick Hall, Vivian stood at the window watching London's carriages pass in the distance, and turned to Gideon with a sharpness in her voice she had not shown before. "London is not pitying Clara anymore," she said. "It is waiting for her." Gideon said nothing, but the words followed him into a sleepless night, and into the weeks that came after, weeks in which he began, slowly and painfully, to understand exactly how much he had thrown away in a single careless sentence spoken before a room full of strangers. That night, unable to sleep, he wandered down to the library alone and found himself standing before the same desk where Clara had once written the speeches that made his name in Parliament. He opened a drawer he had never once thought to search in 21 years of marriage, and found, tucked beneath old correspondence, a small bundle of pressed flowers, roses from their very first spring at Thornwick Hall, tied together with a faded ribbon and a note in Clara's young, careful hand. "For Gideon," the note read, "so that some part of this first spring might last longer than the season allows." He sat down heavily in the chair she had once occupied for so many midnight hours, the dried petals crumbling slightly between his fingers, and understood, with a grief that arrived far too late to matter, that he had been loved thoroughly and completely by a woman he had scarcely bothered to notice, and that no amount of regret now could return to him the years he had spent looking past her, toward brighter, emptier things. Clara attended a diplomatic dinner alone for the first time since the ball, without Gideon's name attached to hers, without his arm to lean upon, carrying only her father's ledger and the quiet confidence she had built brick by brick over the past weeks. At first, the whispers followed her the way they always had, hushed and curious, eyes tracking her across the room as though she were a curiosity rather than a guest. Then something shifted. An elderly duchess rose from her seat to greet her by name. A judge she had never met asked with genuine deference whether she had yet reviewed her father's sealed records concerning a matter of some delicacy in the north. A general nodded to her from across the room with the kind of respect he usually reserved for men twice his age. Clara realized, standing in the middle of that room, that London's treatment of her was no longer shaped by pity or scandal. It was shaped by curiosity of an entirely different kind, the kind reserved for someone the room had decided, quite suddenly, that it needed to understand better. A young woman she barely recognized, the daughter of a minor viscount, approached her near the end of the evening with a nervous curtsy. "Forgive me, Lady Clara, but I wondered whether you might have a moment to advise me. My family has a small dispute with our neighbors over a shared boundary wall, and I did not know who else to ask." Clara looked at the girl's earnest, hopeful face and felt something settle warmly in her chest, an echo of every tenant child she had once knelt beside, every widow she had once written to in careful, patient hand. "Of course," she said. "Tell me everything, and we shall see what can be untangled." It was such a small request, hardly worth mentioning beside treaties and noble feuds, and yet Clara understood, walking the girl through the matter with the same care she gave to every dispute her father's ledger had ever demanded of her, that this was precisely the kind of quiet, unglamorous work her father had built his whole hidden life around. Not grand gestures before Parliament, but small kindnesses extended to people who had nowhere else to turn. Gideon watched her from across the room that same evening, half hidden behind a pillar, as though he might avoid being seen watching her at all. She spoke calmly with men who had ignored her for years at his own dinners, men who now leaned toward her with genuine interest. She looked different to him, not younger, not louder, but freer in some way he could not quite name, as though a weight she had carried for 2 decades had finally been set down. He found himself unable to look away and unable to explain, even to himself, why the sight unsettled him so deeply. Alexander's devotion, meanwhile, had begun to reveal itself in small, quiet gestures that asked for nothing in return. He noticed during a long afternoon of negotiations that Clara had eaten nothing since morning. Without drawing any attention to it, He arranged for a small plate of bread and cheese and a pot of tea to appear at her elbow exactly when she needed it most. "You notice too much, Lord Ashbourne," Clara said, glancing at him over the rim of her teacup, a faint smile tugging at her mouth despite her exhaustion. "Only where noticing matters," he replied, and something in the low warmth of his voice made the simple words feel like far more than politeness. Vivian, for her part, continued to reveal the limits of her understanding. At a gathering that same week, she interrupted an older duchess mid-sentence to make a careless joke about old alliances being tiresome and outdated. The room chilled instantly, and Vivian, oblivious to the offense she had caused, did not understand that she had insulted families whose histories were bound tightly to the very network her father-in-law's rival now quietly controlled. Gideon felt the embarrassment of that moment settle over him like a coat two sizes too small, and for the first time, he wondered whether he had traded something irreplaceable for something merely decorative. That same week, alone in the Thornwick Library, Gideon searched through old correspondence for a document he could not immediately recall, and found instead a stack of drafts in Clara's careful, familiar handwriting. Speeches, dozens of them, spanning years, each one shaped with the precision and warmth that London had once praised so highly in him. He read one aloud to the empty room, and the memory returned with sudden, painful clarity. The applause that had followed those exact words in Parliament, the congratulations he had accepted as though they belonged to him alone. He sat down heavily in his chair, the papers trembling slightly in his hands, and allowed himself, for the first time since the ball, to feel the full shape of what he had lost. Back at Eldermore, a lighter moment offered brief relief from the mounting tension. Alexander's valet, Jasper Clark, discovered his master selecting flowers from the estate's small greenhouse with unusual and uncharacteristic care. "My lord has developed a sudden passion for botany," Jasper observed dryly, holding up a rose Alexander had rejected twice already. "Shall I inform the Royal Society of this remarkable late-blooming interest?" Alexander gave him a long, unimpressed look. Jasper bowed with an expression of perfect, practiced innocence and said nothing further, though the faint curve of his mouth suggested he understood exactly what, or rather whom, his master's newfound interest in flowers truly concerned. That evening, in the quiet of the Eldermore Library, Clara found herself confessing a fear she had not spoken aloud to anyone. "I am afraid," she admitted, her eyes fixed on the fire rather than on Alexander beside her, "of being wanted only when I am useful. I spent 21 years being useful to a man who never once looked past what I could do for him." Alexander was quiet for a long moment before he answered, and when he did, his voice carried none of the careful restraint he usually kept so tightly in place. "Then let me be clear," he said. "I admired your usefulness, Lady Clara. I am undone by your heart." Clara turned to look at him, breath caught somewhere between her chest and her throat, and for a moment the air between them felt charged with everything neither of them had yet allowed themselves to say. Alexander did not press further. He simply held her gaze, steady and unhurried, letting the words settle into the space between them, without demanding anything in return. Days later, reaching for the same letter across a candle-lit table, their hands touched by accident, fingers brushing lightly over aged paper. This time, Clara did not pull away immediately. The moment was small, barely a breath long, but it carried a weight that neither of them mistook for coincidence. The announcement, when it came, arrived with the formality of a summons rather than an invitation. The Lord Chancellor's office declared a formal assembly at Westminster, where Lord Edmund Robinson's sealed national record would finally be read aloud before the assembled peers of England. Clara would attend. Gideon would attend. And London, restless with a question it had been quietly asking for weeks, would finally receive its answer. By the time dawn broke over the city the following morning, every carriage rolling through London streets seemed to carry the same whispered question passed from window to window. Who exactly had Clara Sterling's father truly been? Clara spent the night before the assembly, unable to sleep, sitting instead at the small desk in her London rooms, with her father's ledger open before her, tracing his handwriting with one careful finger, as though the motion might summon some final piece of guidance from beyond the grave. She had spent weeks solving disputes, renewing alliances, proving to a skeptical city that she was capable of carrying her father's work. Tomorrow, she understood, was different. Tomorrow was not about proving her competence to quiet rooms of noblemen who already respected her. Tomorrow was about standing before the whole of London's power in the very hall where Gideon had once been praised for words she had written, and letting the truth finally settle where it belonged. She was not afraid of the assembly itself. She was afraid, if she was honest with herself, of what it might mean to finally be seen so completely after 21 years of choosing invisibility, because invisibility had once felt safer than attention. She did not know, sitting there in the candlelight, whether she still remembered how to stand at the center of a room rather than quietly holding it up from behind. A soft knock interrupted her thoughts. Alexander stood in the doorway when she opened it, still dressed, clearly having found no more sleep than she had. "I could not rest either," he admitted, before she could ask. "Are you afraid?" Clara asked, stepping aside to let him in. "Only of one thing," he said, and when she raised an eyebrow in question, he continued, quieter now. "I am afraid that tomorrow, once all of London understands exactly who you are, you will no longer need a quiet marquis trailing beside you through drawing rooms." Clara studied him for a long moment, surprised by the vulnerability in his voice, so unlike the steady composure he wore for the rest of the world. "You mistake usefulness for the only reason I have kept you close, Lord Ashbourne." "Then tell me the true reason," he said, and there was something raw beneath the careful politeness of the question. Clara considered her answer honestly before she gave it. "Because you are the first person in a very long while who has never once asked me to be smaller than I am." Neither of them spoke again for a long moment, the quiet between them warm rather than uncomfortable. And when Alexander finally took his leave that night, he pressed a single, lingering kiss to the back of her hand, his lips lingering a moment longer than propriety strictly required. Clara stood in the doorway long after he had gone, her hand still faintly warm where his mouth had touched it, and found that whatever fear she had carried into that evening had quietly transformed into something closer to readiness. Westminster Hall had never, in Clara's memory, held an atmosphere quite like the one that greeted her that morning. Cabinet ministers filled the front benches. Dukes, earls, and marquises crowded the galleries above. Judges sat in solemn rows beside generals whose chests bore decorations earned in wars, most of the room had only read about in newspapers. Royal representatives occupied the seats of highest honor, their presence a silent declaration that whatever was about to happen here mattered a great deal more than an ordinary matter of politics. The air did not feel like politics at all. It felt like judgment, heavy and waiting, pressing down on every person who entered the hall. Gideon arrived early, Vivian on his arm, expecting the discomfort of old acquaintances avoiding his eye after the scandal of the ball. Instead, he found something far more disorienting. No one seemed particularly interested in him at all. Conversations paused only long enough for people to ask, in careful, curious tones, whether Lady Clara Stirling had yet arrived. Vivian heard the question repeated 3 times in the space of 10 minutes, and her spine stiffened a little more with each repetition. When Clara finally entered, the room's attention shifted as completely as a tide turning. She wore a simple gown of dark blue, a single strand of pearls at her throat, and no ducal brooch at all. She did not need one. Alexander walked beside her, not touching her, but near enough that his presence seemed to steady the very air around her. Heads turned. Whispers moved through the galleries in a wave. Her name passed from mouth to mouth with a reverence that had been entirely absent the last time this many powerful people had gathered in one room to witness her. Lord Benedict Randolph rose from his seat at the front of the hall, and the room fell silent before he had even spoken a single word. "For 35 years, he began, his voice carrying easily through the vast chamber, "Lord Edmund Robinson served the Crown of England in a capacity none of you were meant to know. He settled disputes between our great houses before they could ripen into scandal. He prevented feuds that would have spilled blood across counties and generations. He protected treaties that kept peace where pride alone would have brought war. He preserved the stability of this nation during crises that most of you never even knew existed, because he ensured, through decades of quiet and thankless labor, that you never would." A murmur rippled through the assembly, disbelief and recognition tangled together in equal measure. One by one, witnesses rose to speak. Lord Charles Holloway stood first, his voice thick with old gratitude, and told the assembly how Edmund Robinson had saved his sons from a feud that would have ended in bloodshed and ruin. General Arthur Wallace followed, describing the crisis of supplies that Edmund had quietly resolved while generals accepted the credit for a rescue they had not truly engineered. Duke Augustus Belgrave rose to speak of a treaty Edmund had protected at great personal risk. Judge Leonard Faulkner spoke last among them, describing a scandal that could have shaken the judiciary itself had Edmund not intervened with careful, patient diplomacy. Each testimony added another layer to a portrait of a man the room had never truly known, a man who had chosen decades of invisible service over even a fraction of the recognition being poured out for him now. Too late for him to hear it. A hush fell over the gallery as each testimony ended. The peers of England looking at one another as though recalculating, quietly and privately, every assumption they had ever made about the quiet gentleman who had spent so many holidays at Eldermore, tending roses and reading by the fire. Clara listened to every word with her hands folded tightly in her lap, memorizing details she knew she would carry with her for the rest of her life. Proof after proof of a father whose love for his country had never once required an audience to be real. Alexander rose last among the witnesses. He stood tall in the center of the hall, and though his voice remained steady, Clara could hear the depth of feeling beneath it. "Edmund Robinson taught me that nobility without service is only costume," he said, his gaze sweeping across the assembled peers before settling, briefly, on Clara. "And I have seen his daughter prove that lesson in every room she has entered these past weeks." Clara felt her eyes fill with tears she refused to let fall. She held Alexander's gaze for a long moment, and something passed between them that the entire hall seemed to sense, even if none of them understood its full shape. Lord Randolph spoke again, his voice carrying the full weight of formal announcement. Lord Edmund Robinson left no son. He accepted no title and held no official office through which his work might pass by right of inheritance. But he left a daughter, and it is the unanimous agreement of every house and every man who once relied upon his quiet service that Lady Clara Stirling be recognized from this day forward as the custodian of her father's unfinished work. The response began slowly. One old duke rose from his seat first, his hand pressed briefly to his chest, then another. Then a judge stood, then a general, until the movement spread through the hall like a wave gathering strength, until nearly the entire assembly stood together in silent, unbroken respect. London rose for Clara. Gideon remained seated, unable to move, unable to draw a full breath. He remembered another room, another silence, one that had crushed Clara beneath its weight while he stood at the center of it with his hand at another woman's waist. Now silence had returned, transformed entirely, and it was honoring the very woman he had once humiliated before the same city that now rose in her name. He understood, in that terrible, clarifying moment, that Clara had not become extraordinary after leaving him. She had always been extraordinary. He had simply been too consumed by his own comfort, too accustomed to the quiet ease of her devotion, to ever truly see her. After the assembly dispersed into 100 separate conversations, Alexander found Clara alone in a quiet corridor away from the crowd, her hands still trembling faintly from the weight of everything she had just witnessed. He approached slowly, giving her every chance to step away if she wished it. "May I?" he asked softly, extending his hand toward hers. Clara nodded, and he took her hands gently, holding them with a reverence that asked for nothing beyond the moment itself. Neither of them spoke. The corridor was quiet, and the intimacy between them needed no further words to fill it. It was into this fragile stillness that Gideon's voice intruded, low and urgent, from the end of the corridor. "I need to speak with my wife." Clara turned to face him, her hands still resting in Alexander's, and something in her had settled so completely over these past weeks that her voice, when it came, carried no anger at all, only a quiet, unshakable finality. "You may speak with Lady Clara," she said. Gideon stood frozen at the end of the corridor, absorbing the correction as though it carried the full weight of a verdict. He had expected anger from her, or perhaps tears, something familiar he might know how to answer. He had not expected calm. He had not expected to feel, standing there in front of the woman he had once discarded so carelessly, like the smaller of the two people in that hallway. "Clara," he tried again, softer this time, though he did not correct himself to the name she had actually offered him. "Not tonight, Gideon," Clara said, and though the words were gentle, they left no room for argument. "You have had 21 years to speak with me. I think you can manage to wait a little longer for the right moment to try again properly." She did not wait for his response. She simply turned, her hand still resting easily in Alexander's, and walked with him back toward the hall, leaving Gideon standing alone in the quiet corridor, with nothing but the echo of a name he no longer had any right to claim. The chamber Gideon led her to was small and quiet, tucked away from the noise of Westminster's departing crowds, and Clara stepped inside, feeling none of the dread she might have expected only weeks earlier. She felt, instead, a strange and steady calm, the kind that comes only after a woman has already survived the worst a room can do to her. Gideon closed the door behind them and stood for a long moment without speaking, his hands loose at his sides, his composure gone in a way Clara had never once witnessed in 21 years of marriage. He had always known how to command a room, how to arrange his face into confidence, even when he felt none. Now he simply looked at her, and she saw for the first time a man who had run entirely out of performances. "I do not know how to begin," he admitted. "Then begin honestly," Clara said. "It is the one thing you have never quite managed with me." He flinched at that, though he did not argue. He crossed to the window and stood with his back to her for a moment, gathering himself, and when he turned around again, his voice had lost the polished ease London had always admired in him. "I used your devotion," he said slowly, as though each word cost him something. "I ignored your intelligence because it was easier to accept your silence as duty than to acknowledge how much of my own life you were carrying for me. I told myself for 21 years that I was the one holding this family together, and I never once stopped to ask myself why the house never fell apart despite how little I actually did to prevent it." Clara said nothing, letting the silence stretch, giving him the space to finish what he had clearly been rehearsing since the moment London rose to its feet for her father's memory. "I thought," he continued, his voice breaking slightly, "that by choosing someone new, I was choosing excitement, brightness, a future that felt less like duty and more like desire. I did not understand, until I watched you stand in that hall today, that I had not traded duty for desire at all. I had simply removed the very foundation my entire life was built upon, and called it freedom." "And now?" Clara asked quietly. "Now I understand what I lost," Gideon said. "I thought I had replaced you, Clara. I had only removed the foundation beneath my own life, and I have spent every day since watching that life slowly crumble without you in it." Clara listened to all of it, and she found, to her own quiet surprise, that she believed every word. She did not doubt his regret. She did not doubt that it was genuine, hard won, and long overdue. But belief in his regret was not the same as belief that regret alone could undo 21 years of being unseen. "I forgive you, Gideon," she said, and meant it completely. "I do not carry anger toward you any longer. It would cost me more than it would ever cost you, and I have grown too fond of the life I am building to spend it on bitterness." Hope flickered briefly across his face, and Clara felt a small, private ache at having to extinguish it so soon after offering him peace. "But forgiveness," she continued, "is not permission to return." "Is there any chance," Gideon asked, his voice barely above a whisper, "that we might begin again?" Clara considered the question honestly, the way she considered every question that mattered, weighing it against everything she had learned about herself these past weeks. "I spent 21 years being your duchess," she said finally. "I built your reputation in rooms you never entered, and I built your peace in a marriage you barely noticed, keeping you steady. I do not regret the woman that work made me. But I must spend the rest of my life being Clara, not the Duchess of Thornwick Hall, not a name attached to yours by law and habit. Simply Clara. And I do not believe that woman can exist inside the marriage we built." Gideon lowered his head, and though grief moved plainly across his face, he did not argue further. Some part of him, Clara suspected, had already known the answer before he asked the question, and had simply needed to hear it spoken aloud to finally let go of the hope he had been quietly nursing since the assembly. "May I ask you one thing," he said quietly, before she reached the door, "and receive an honest answer." Clara paused, her hand resting on the handle. "You may ask." "Did you love him," Gideon said, "before you ever stopped loving me? Or did I simply hand you to another man's arms the night I stopped looking at you at all?" Clara considered the question with the same careful honesty she gave to everything that mattered. "I did not love Alexander while I still belonged to you, Gideon, if that is what troubles you. I did not permit myself even to notice him in that way, until long after you had already chosen someone else before the whole of London. But I will not pretend the ground was not already cracking beneath us long before that night at the ball. You stopped looking at me years before you ever stopped speaking my name at dinner. A woman notices when she becomes furniture in her own home, even if she spends a long while telling herself she has imagined it." Gideon absorbed this without argument, and something in his shoulders seemed to settle, as though the honesty, however painful, had at least given him something solid to finally stand upon. "Thank you," he said simply, "for not lying to spare me. I spent 21 years softening truths for your comfort," Clara said, not unkindly. "I find I no longer have the appetite for it." She left him standing alone in that quiet chamber, and though she felt the weight of the conversation settle over her for the rest of the evening, she did not feel the familiar urge to return and comfort him through it, the way she once would have, without a second thought. That instinct, she realized with quiet satisfaction, had finally, truly gone. Vivian's departure from the story, when it came, arrived without the drama either she or Gideon might once have imagined for themselves. She had entered Gideon's life believing she would inherit a title, a fortune, and the admiration Clara had once commanded so effortlessly. What she found instead, in the weeks following the Westminster Assembly, was a household that no longer respected her, a husband whose attention had turned entirely inward toward regret, and a society that had quietly decided she would never possess the quiet authority Clara had built through decades of unseen labor. Vivian was not a foolish woman, whatever her earlier mistakes had suggested. She recognized, with a clarity that did her credit, that remaining at Thornwick Hall would only ever mean living in a shadow she could not outgrow. Within the month, she had accepted an invitation from a distant relation to travel abroad, and she left Thornwick Hall quietly, without confrontation, choosing a different kind of future rather than continuing to chase one that had already slipped irretrievably from her grasp. Months passed, and Clara's life at Eldermore took on a shape she had never dared to imagine for herself. She continued her father's work with a confidence that grew steadier with every dispute resolved, every fragile alliance renewed, every family guided gently away from the kind of ruin that pride alone might have brought upon them. She became, in the quiet estimation of London's most powerful circles, one of the most trusted women in England, consulted not because of a title she no longer held, but because of judgment she had earned through her own hands. But she no longer poured herself entirely into invisibility the way she once had for Gideon. She rested when her body demanded rest. She laughed, freely and often, at Jasper's dry commentary and at the small joys the tenant children brought to Eldermore's once quiet gardens. She chose each day how much of herself to give, rather than surrendering all of it by habit and calling it love. Alexander remained close throughout those months, but he never once rushed her, never pressed for more than she was ready to offer. He escorted her to meetings when she wished for company, and remained silent when she preferred to work alone. He walked beside her through Eldermore's gardens in the evenings, sent her books with small, thoughtful notes written in the margins and sat across from her by the fire in comfortable silence that asked nothing of her beyond her presence. Clara found, slowly, and without any single dramatic realization, that she had fallen in love with him. Not suddenly, not in the reckless way young women fell in love in the novels she had read as a girl, but gradually, the way warmth spreads through a room long after the fire has been lit. She loved him, not because he had rescued her from ruin, but because he had made room, patiently and without demand, for her to rescue herself first. The confession, when it finally came, arrived on an evening when the sky over Eldermore had turned the deep gold of late summer, and the roses her father had once tended so carefully hung heavy with scent in the warm evening air. Alexander led her to the same garden where he had once caught her before she fell, and there, with the last light of the day spilling across the stone paths, he took both her hands in his. "England knows the remarkable woman you have become," he said, his voice low and unhurried, carrying none of the careful restraint he had once used to guard his feelings. "I should like the privilege of loving the woman you have always been." He did not kneel. He simply offered his hand, palm open, an invitation rather than a demand, a request rather than a claim. Clara placed her hand in his without hesitation, and felt, as his fingers closed gently around hers, the last remnants of 21 years of quiet sacrifice finally settle into something that felt at last like peace. Their kiss, when it came, was slow and unhurried, filled with the particular tenderness of two people who had spent months denying feelings neither of them had truly wanted to deny. It carried none of the desperate hunger of stolen moments, and all of the quiet, aching relief of two hearts finally allowed to rest in the place they had wanted to be for a very long time. Clara felt the warmth of his hand at the small of her back, careful and reverent, and understood, in that single, unhurried moment, the difference between a man who had once held her out of habit and a man who held her now because he had chosen her, deliberately and completely, with his whole heart. Several months later, Clara married Alexander in a small countryside chapel not far from Eldermore Manor. The chapel held none of the grandeur of the royal spring ball, none of the crystal chandeliers or royal representatives that had once surrounded her in the worst moment of her life. It held instead the people who had actually shaped her days, tenants whose farms she had once saved from ruin, servants who had watched her grow from a young bride into a woman who commanded respect through kindness rather than titles, children who ran between the pews throwing early wildflowers, and old allies of her father who had come not for politics, but because Clara herself had touched their lives in ways no ledger could ever properly record. Gideon stood at the back of the chapel, having asked permission to attend and having received it without hesitation, because Clara no longer needed to punish him to feel whole. He watched Alexander look at Clara as she walked toward him, and he saw, with a clarity that arrived far too late to change anything, the difference between the way he had once looked at her and the way Alexander looked at her now. He had looked at Clara, for most of their marriage, the way a man looks at something reliable, something that would always be there when he finally remembered to notice it. Alexander looked at her the way a man looks at something rare, something he understood with his whole chest that he had very nearly missed. Gideon was not angry, standing there at the back of that small chapel. He felt only a quiet, settled grief, the kind that comes when a man finally understands the true size of what he lost, long after there is anything left to be done about it. He understood, at last, that Alexander had not received some improved version of the woman Gideon once knew. He had simply received the same woman, fully seen, fully cherished, in a way Gideon had never once thought to offer her himself. Clara and Alexander walked from the chapel together as husband and wife, sunlight spilling gold across the path before them, tenant children scattering flowers at their feet with the unrestrained joy only children possess. Clara felt none of the hollow grandeur that had once surrounded her at the Royal Spring Ball, none of the silence that had once followed her out of that glittering room like a funeral bell. She felt, instead, the steady warmth of a hand closed gently around her own, asking nothing of her that she was not already glad to give. She had once believed, for 21 long years, that love meant standing quietly behind a man, holding up everything the world was never meant to see. She understood now, walking down that sunlit path beside a man who had never once asked her to disappear, that true love did not ask a woman to vanish into someone else's greatness. It made room for her to shine in her own. That evening, after the guests had departed and the chapel bells had gone quiet, Clara and Alexander walked together through the same rose garden where he had first caught her in the rain, now dressed in the soft golden light of a summer evening that seemed determined to linger. Mrs. Pruitt had left a small supper waiting in the manor, but neither of them hurried toward it. They walked slowly instead, her hand tucked into the crook of his arm, both of them content to simply exist together in the quiet, without any dispute to settle or any ledger to balance between them. Your father would have liked this garden used for something other than treaties and secrets, Alexander said, glancing at the roses climbing the old stone wall. He would have liked you, Clara said, and meant it completely. He always did trust the quiet ones more than the loud ones. He used to say a man's character showed itself best in rooms where no one was watching. Alexander stopped walking and turned to face her fully, his expression softer than she had ever seen it, stripped of every careful restraint he had once worn like armor against his own feelings. Then I hope I have passed his particular test, since it seems I am the only judge of my own character left standing in this garden tonight. You passed it, Clara said, the moment you laid your coat over my knees in a carriage, and never once asked me to notice you for it. He laughed then, low and warm, a sound she had come to treasure more than she ever expected to treasure anything again after that terrible night in the ballroom. He drew her closer, and for a long moment they simply stood together beneath the darkening sky, the scent of roses thick in the evening air. Two people who had each spent years believing love required sacrifice of the self, finally learning together that it required nothing of the kind. Somewhere beyond the garden wall, the last of the wedding guests made their way home along the country road, carrying with them stories of a duchess who had lost a title and found, in its place, something far harder to take from her. And somewhere in London, in a house grown quiet and unfamiliar, Gideon sat alone by a fire that no longer warmed him the way it once had, finally understanding the true and lasting cost of a single, careless night. But Clara did not think of London that evening, nor of the ballroom, nor of the silence that had once followed her out into the fog like something meant to break her. She thought only of the man beside her, the warmth of his hand in hers, and the quiet, steady certainty that whatever came next, she would meet it as herself, fully seen, fully chosen, and finally, entirely free. The rose garden at Eldermore would go on blooming every summer for years afterward, tended now by two people rather than one lonely widower, and the story London told of the Duchess who lost a title and gained a legacy would soften over time into something gentler still. The story of a woman who had spent 21 years believing she was ordinary, only to discover, in the wreckage of a single, cruel evening, that she had never been ordinary at all. Somewhere in that quiet garden, a very old, very patient love story between a father and the daughter he never stopped protecting had finally, fully come to rest. If Clara's story gave you hope, hit like, it helps more people find her. Subscribe for more stories like this one. Share it with someone who needs it. And tell me in the comments, where are you watching from tonight? Thank you for staying till the end. See you in the next one.